Let's breathe and relax. Just feel ourselves settled deeply in the spine. Feel the power of stillness and the power of calmness. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Teshwar, Beloved Master, Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to open our minds and hearts to your guiding wisdom, that we may receive whatever understanding will help us to draw closer to thee. Om. Peace. Amen. We'll meditate now for a few minutes. Om. Peace. Amen. I usually start by asking you if you have a particular slant on this topic, if there's something you would particularly like to hear discussed today. So if you don't mind, I'll ask you that. I know you all, so I don't have to ask you who you are. Is there a particular interest you have in this topic today?
I wouldn't say anything particular. I'm just ready to listen.
Okay, that's good enough. Jan?
I'm always interested in the chakras and in the spine and the importance of everything working together and being clear to help have a clearer mind. And it's an Asha class. Here.
Okay, that works. All right.
Over the last few years, I've been able to understand and feel that my essence of the soul and what it represents is in the spine.
Uh-huh.
I've never had that concept before.
Right.
The more I'm learning about it, the more I can sense it.
Right.
This is an important part.
Uh-huh.
Like a sponge, to learn more about it.
No, that's very valid. That's very good. Nancy?
Well, I just started yoga about 3 years ago, and that's when I first was introduced to the concept of chakras, but
uh-huh.
I never quite got to the point where I did much study, so anything I learn, I'm ready.
Okay, excellent. Hi, come on in. Okay, we have one more. I just want to, if we can bring you into the front row, that would be nice. Can we just do this with that? Yeah, let's just pull a chair. Here. We can pull a chair by Art. That will work out really well. Yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
Certainly. And your name is?
Paulina. I'm one of the teachers.
Oh, Paulina. Okay. Oh, that's right. Be careful, there's a camera behind you, so if you could just slip a little back over toward right. Yes. You do the music. You do the Spanish or the music?
The Spanish.
The Spanish.
Yeah,
okay.
Spanish.
Welcome, Paulina. Okay.
You.
I was just asking people what their particular interest was in this class. Can I ask? Why don't I ask Opal first? He was going to say.
I just listened to your series on the chakras on YouTube,
uh-huh.
And it was very interesting. It's something that I didn't have a good understanding
of. Okay.
Before, so you're just going to widen my knowledge.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. And what about you, Paulina?
Okay. Relationships, of course, the chakras.
Just the?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any background in this, or are you being introduced today?
No. I don't have any background with the chakras.
Uh-huh.
I took a workshop here a long time ago, and I don't remember anymore. And I'm spiritual, and I'm just very confused about relationships now, because I'm single.
Okay,
yeah.
So that side of it is important. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Just, Gopal mentioned, I did a series that's on YouTube on the chakras. I did it a few years ago. I actually was doing it for an Indian audience for a while. I was doing live webinars for India, but I had to do them at 7 in the morning or 6 in the morning. And then when the time changed, I would have had to do them at 5 or something like that. So I dropped it. But I did 4 classes on the chakras, which for some reason really worked. And if you go on Asha YouTube channel, which if you go to Asha Joy, but I can say all that, it's downstairs. But if you really want a sort of a very systematic approach to the chakras, those 4 classes seem to have really done it. I'm standing up in front of a curtain with a little board next to me. It does not look very professional, but it worked. And also, I traveled to New Zealand in 2013, and I gave a lot of classes all over the North Island there. And I was introducing people to a lot of these teachings. So that whole tour, which is on YouTube as a whole group, it's a really good, they're comprehensive, but they start like explaining the whole thing up. There's no assumption because of the audience I was with. So those also are very good if you're just really trying to get curriculum. And I may have done relationships. I think I did a few times, and just everything. I did basically the whole self-realization curriculum because it was a whole new situation. Okay. So we have 2 aspects that we're talking about today. And one is fundamentally what the chakras are, how do they work with us, what does it serve us to know. And then the other aspect of it, because the chakras are really the found, isn't that marvelous, all that construction? Okay. Yeah, perhaps you can. The energy of the chakras, as I'll explain, is really the defining reality of our lives, even though it seems hidden and it seems, I don't think there's anything we can do. Is there anything else that's open? No, I think this is just what we live with. Oh, well, that helps a tiny bit. Okay, thank you. Nope, that's it. And thank you. Yeah, double pane windows really do help. So the energy of the chakras, much more than we know, and as I said, I'll explain this as we go along, really dictates our life experience. So once we can, and what understanding the chakras does for us is it gives us an overview of what's going on in our lives. Because otherwise, everything seems unrelated. You know, just this happens here, my job goes like this, my relationships go like this, my health goes like this, my physical body, my culture. It all seems unrelated, but it's actually not at all unrelated. It's all a very integrated system. At the same time, it's a complicated system. The principles can be explained simply, but to actually understand them is the work of many incarnations. And then specifically, we'll talk about how those particular energies in the chakras manifest in our lives, which is an important part of it, with a special emphasis on how it happens in our relationships with others. Okay? And there are really 3 very important principles that always have to be considered together, which is the chakras, which is the law of karma, and then the inevitability of reincarnation.
See, the law of karma?
The law of karma. Is reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Because none of them actually work without an understanding of the other 2. So we have to put it all together. Reincarnation, pardon me? It's being recorded. And so you can relax. And within a day or two, if you want to review it, you can go back. You're more than welcome to take notes, but you don't have to. It's up to you. That's one of the reasons we record, is then people can relax and they don't have to. Because I cram a lot of information into a short period of time. But we can stop and ask questions whenever you don't understand. It's perfect. All right. So we had these 3 words. Karma, reincarnation, and the chakras. So, before we can really talk about how the chakras relate to relationships, we have to understand what we're dealing with the chakras. But we have to back up, and this is where karma and reincarnation come into the picture, into this understanding of things. We have to make very deep and serious decisions within ourselves as to what the purpose of our life is. You know, we tend to have a really sort of simple explanation for our life is that we want to be happy. I mean, very few people really want to be unhappy, although many people become deeply committed to ways of thinking and ways of being that we cling to, even though they don't make us happy. But there's a part of us that just somehow knows that I was put on this planet for some uplifted sense of joy. And if we really didn't believe that we had, that was our true destiny and our true nature, we would just be content with whatever happens. It's like we don't sit around, most of us, unless you're really crazy, just lamenting the fact that we're not mermaids, you know, or that we're not tigers in the forest or something like that, because there's no part of us that actually thinks that that's what I can be. But happy is something that we all know we're supposed to be. So when we're not, there's always a sense of there's something off here. We may explain that in all sorts of ways. I'm unhappy because I'm not married. I'm unhappy because I am married. I'm unhappy because I don't have children. I'm unhappy because my children are such lousy people. You know, I don't have a job. I hate my job. Whatever it is, but it's all related to this idea that we're somehow supposed to have a positive experience of life, and if we're not having it, we push against that edge. Now, people who don't think deeply just explain it self-evidently. You know, well, I need that, and therefore, if I don't have it, I'm unhappy. People who think more deeply and pay attention over a longer rhythm begin to see other patterns at work here. You know, that even when I got that job that was supposed to be so great, somehow I still wasn't happy inside. Everything is going just the way it should, but now I'm afraid I'm going to lose it. I mean, there's just always something that comes in that keeps us from being happy. And one of the points that I often emphasize when I'm talking about these teachings is a very simple one, which is all we ever actually experience is what our own state of mind is. And we believe that our state of mind is dictated by our external circumstances. Well, naturally, I'm unhappy. I'm in the hospital about to have a very painful operation. Who wouldn't be unhappy? Or, you know, naturally, I'm happy because this is my wedding day and I'm marrying my soulmate and everything is going to be perfect. But what we're actually experiencing is the way we feel inside our heads. Swami Kriyananda once, I was with him and we were at some doctor's or somewhere. And he was asked to make a checklist. He was asked all these questions about his health. And Swami Kriyananda's health was fascinating to doctors. His medical records went around the planet. The colleagues would send them to each other because they were so interesting. Because fact of the matter was, he was working not only his own karma, but he was working everybody else's karma. He was using his body for a different reason. But he wrote down, you know, all the different things he had. You know, he'd had colitis, and he'd had his hip replaced, and he had open heart surgery, and he had kidney stones, and he just went, and he had diabetes at that point, and then he had high blood pressure, and he just went on and on. And then it said, how would you rate your overall health? Excellent, he said, just excellent. Because that is how he felt about it. These were the conditions, but in his own way of thinking, it was all excellent. What was the problem? He's in the hospital once, having a near-death experience, either from pneumonia or kidney failure toward the end of his life. And how are you doing? Oh, I'm just blissful, he said. Mm-hmm. His body was a mess, but his own state of mind was not dependent on that mess. So when we start thinking more seriously about life, we become interested. At some point we begin to observe this, that my state of mind is independent of my circumstances. And whereas all of our training up until that point is how to change our circumstances, at some point it occurs to us that what I really need to change is my own inner experience of my circumstances. Now, at some point is where this concept of reincarnation comes in. Because the question is, how fast do we learn and what does it take for us to learn? If we think of the entire span of our conscious existence as us just coming out of the womb, or maybe, you know, at the moment of conception, but let's say coming out of the womb, and we're a little baby and we start going for life, and then there's a point at which the body has aged itself into uselessness and it stops. The heart stops and we stop breathing and we're gone. Is that it? Is our whole opportunity, is we can only accomplish, we can only experience as much as we can fit into that little space? I go swimming over at the YMCA, and they have these classes for parents and little small children, you know, very small children. And I often I share the pool sometimes with those children. They cut it in the middle and I'm on one side, and I always really enjoy them because they're so adorable, and their parents, you know, each child has a parent or a grandparent, and you know, it's very intense because each adult adores the baby and is just totally focused on the baby. But this morning they put the little kids on this sort of floating styrofoam platform thing. You know, they're just trying to get them used to the water. There was just one little boy who was like so uncertain about the whole experience. He was probably about a year, maybe two, maybe he was as old as two. But he had this look in his eye the whole time, you know, of this great concern, you know, like, is the engineering of this platform sound? Does my mother really have a grip on me? You know, what will happen if I fall in that water? And other children, you could see, were just completely unconcerned. They just didn't have any idea. But this child was analyzing his situation, and it was coming up short. But the point of that was, just watching these little tiny ones, you know, just starting in building this, and how different they all are. Of course, in this area, there was every ethnic mix that you could imagine, just right there on the little platform all together. So they're all making their different bodies and speaking their different languages just in one swimming pool. Now, if we think, which I have long since abandoned, that existence is only from that birth to death, then what happens from birth to death it matters a lot less. Because if you can get away with it, what difference does it make? But if we realize, which I know to be true, that when we're born, it's just turning the page from a previous, it's a continuous long book. And just as an author will end a chapter and then start a new one, and end a chapter and start a new one. And sometimes if there are different characters in the book, you'll leave these characters behind and then you'll study these and then new ones, they'll come back again. So we have to really think about ourselves, even though we don't consciously, although sometimes we do consciously, remember everything we've done in our past incarnations. Listen, how many of you can remember what you did last Saturday? It's like the human memory is not that terrific. And large pieces of it go away. And 10 years ago, on this day, 10 years ago, who knows? 15, 20, 50 years ago? I mean, we have fragments. But really, I think we remember our past lives about the same. We just don't know what we're remembering. Oh, I've never had curry before, but I find it delicious. You know, what is that word? What is that word for house? Casa. Don't they call it casa, they say? You know? Like, how do I know that? How do children know things? That languages sound familiar, unfamiliar. A style of dress. Oh, I really like the oriental collar. Why do I like the oriental collar? Well, maybe I spend incarnations wearing it. You know, you don't know where these things come from. We have all these inclinations. So once we take reincarnation into the picture, what that says is that this quest for happiness and this eventually figuring out that what I really need to change is my inner experience, not my outer circumstances. We go through lots of experiences and we build up knowledge very slowly, but we also have a very open-ended time in which to learn. And it matters a great deal what happens, what I was starting to say, from birth to death, if that's all there is. Look, if you can do it and get away with it and die, then why not? And what we see in our culture right now, which is an enormous absence of a sense of responsibility. That's all right, this happens all the time. what we see right now in our culture, which is a disregard of the consequences of our actions, if we can get away with it. You know, we see that in the financial markets and in lots of places, people's thought form, because they don't believe in reincarnation, they don't believe in karma, and they don't know anything about the chakras naturally, or if they do, they don't understand it. So if I can get away with it, why not? Because if it's all going to get wiped out at death anyway, what difference does it make? If, however, you are realizing, and this is where the three come together, that everything that happens ever in this lifetime or any other stays with me and creates, you know, there's a cause and effect relationship between everything I ever did and my present life experience, and there will be a cause and effect relationship between everything I'm doing now and what my future experience will be. I mean, reincarnation and karma and chakras is the medium by which these things happen. It's just a marvelous system, because all of a sudden everything makes sense. We might not like the answers, but there are at least potential, very definite and very clear answers about what we're doing. Okay, does that make sense? So assuming that our common sense experience is true and that we really are here to be happy and that we have to keep at it, keep trying until that happiness is realized, but we add into it the possibility that we're working on this for a longer rhythm. You add into it the idea that it's not really our circumstances per se that define our happiness, but it's our inner relationship to those circumstances, what we allow it or don't allow it to do to our consciousness, then the whole thing gets very interesting, doesn't it? Now, the other thing that we have to work with is this word happy, and I've touched it by saying inner consciousness versus outer circumstances, which, you know, which is the most important one. Now, once we sort of get into this world, we start stepping into the question of, are there actual discoverable universal principles that affect everyone's happiness? On this particular planet, planet Earth, India, which is a word you all know, has always had the role. And the best way to put it, India has always been the guru of the planet, just culturally. Because in India, more than any other culture, even though India's, you know, having its own karma at this particular time, but the underlying principles that have always sustained the culture of India have been the fundamental principles of the universe itself. And the principles, the word is very simple, it's Sanatan Dharma. And an autobiography of a yogi, Yogananda's book, talks about the characteristic feature of Indian culture has always been the search for eternal verities and the concomitant, he says, then disciple-guru relationship. We're not going to be dealing with the disciple-guru relationship so much today. But the fundamental characteristic of Indian culture has always been the search for eternal verities. Would you say that the fundamental principle of American culture is the search for eternal verities? No. It's the pursuit of money and stuff. And what would you say the fundamental quality of the Italian temperament is, or the Spanish, or the German, or the French? Everyone has, every culture has its own orientation, one way or another. But India has always been for eternal truth. And countries, it's, well, I won't go into that right now, but countries are there to serve the individual souls. They're vibrations that we can tune into. Sanatana Dharma simply means eternal truth. And this is, Sanatana Dharma is the defining truth behind everything that becomes religion. And a religion, the truth or fallacy of a religion is defined in how close it conforms to Sanatana Dharma. And this isn't just a prejudice on my part, but I'm not going to really justify it at great length. I'll just say it. But the principle of Sanatana Dharma explains that, in fact, what we are here to experience is happiness. But that happiness is an inherent state of consciousness that we are always drifting away from and then need to come back to. The phrase that they use is Satchidananda. Satchidananda is a word that actually can be translated as the word God. Ananda means bliss, ever-existing, ever-conscious. And it means, and this word can be called God, but it means ever-existing, ever-aware of itself, ever-new joy. Now, if you were going to ask yourself, what would you like? You would like to always be conscious of bliss, wouldn't you? I mean, if we were always conscious of bliss, what else would we need? So if you fast forward through this whole thing and really ask ourselves if it's our internal state of consciousness that we're trying to affect, let's go all the way to the end point. Ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. What could be better? Imagine yourself in a concentration camp, but you're conscious of ever. You're not afraid of death, you're not afraid of discomfort, because you understand that this is who I really am. So the goal of Sanatana Dharma is the realization of Satchidananda, which is God realization, self-realization. Mm. Now, it's not something that you can do from the time you come out of the womb till you take your last breath. I mean, just like that. And it's not that some people are lucky. It's that every incarnation is a chapter in the book, and we just keep moving toward it. And so in the course of one lifetime, we learn something. And we may learn to play the piano beautifully, we may learn to be a great painter, we may learn to relate to people in a wonderful way. But everything that we accomplish externally is meaningful because one way or another we're developing inner qualities. I mean, I know that you teach the children, and you can look at those children, and one of the difficulties that a great many children have when they're trying to learn is they're too restless and they can't concentrate. And then you have other children who already know how to concentrate. A few years ago, when Swami Kriyananda visited here, and meaning Palo Alto, he came to school and had an assembly with the children. And the children knew he was coming, and they all made him greeting cards. And they presented this stack of greeting cards, and to everyone's surprise, Swami unwrapped every bundle, looked at every card, and related to every child. That was the last visit he had here, as it happened. But it was very interesting, because he picked up like some very young child, and every child would stand up, and then to some he said, "You really need to concentrate better." And, you know, the teachers would think, this child is just four, but Swami wasn't relating to the child. He just, you need to concentrate better. He made very, not to everyone, sometimes he'd just say something, but to some of them he made very specific comments about what qualities they needed to develop. 4, 5, 6 years old, it was incredible just sort of to watch. And he'd look at the card and then he'd look at the child and then he'd make a suggestion if he felt to make one. But the reason children go to school, what happens when they go to school, especially when they go to school here, Living Wisdom School, because we understand this, that the point is you're trying to develop their inner qualities, because when you develop their inner qualities, they can succeed at everything they do. If you just manage to get them to ace the tests, they know nothing. Once they're not taking tests, they don't know anything anymore. They need to develop their inner self. And what we're developing is the qualities that will put us in tune with Satchidananda. Now, there's a complicated obstacle course that God has put in front of us, and it's the way we're created, and I can't tell you why. You can ask me, and I don't know why. But this is what has happened to us, which is even though Satchitananda is our actual nature and our true destiny, we kind of like get shot out of a gun somewhere in this process, and we get pushed way far away from it, and we're facing the wrong direction, and all this wrong advice is in our head. So when a great saint or even a self-realized master, an avatar, I think of it like this. We're in the astral world where we're not really any more spiritually advanced than we are here. It's just material world is, the astral world is thinner, so we can see things more clearly. But when we incarnate, it's like we get thrown over this really big wall. And this big wall goes up, and so we don't remember our spiritual nature as much. And we don't see ourselves as we really are, as we see ourselves more clearly in the astral world, because we it's energy and we see the pattern more easily. But we get drawn back, and I'll explain when I get more into the chakras and karma, we get drawn back. And what our real goal is that we have to tunnel back through that wall to get back into our expanded self, because we've been constricted by this body. When a great saint gets thrown over the wall, he immediately turns to the wall and tries to tunnel back through it. So he becomes devotional, he thinks about spiritual things, he pays attention to his consciousness, he tries to be compassionate and kind, he looks for a guru, he does sadhana, he's determined, and he gradually tunnels back through that wall. His example to us in this world is that, that's the direction we're supposed to be facing. That's what we're supposed to be doing. The master has taken a physical body, and he's bound by the same conditions we're bound, so he has to actually tunnel back through the wall. He doesn't just hop back over it. If he was going to hop back over it, he never would have come over in the first place. We get thrown over the wall. We turn our backs to the wall, and we see all these shiny objects, and we run away from the wall, and we start trying to fill our basket with stuff, you know, whatever it is, people, experiences, money, power. And you know, we don't even know the wall is there, but to speak of paying attention to how to get back through it. But we do that enough times, meaning enough lifetimes, and we begin to notice what Yogananda calls a certain anguishing monotony to the whole thing. It just doesn't quite come out the way we want it to come out. A friend of mine was talking about, she's very deeply involved here, and she has a group of women who are college friends, and they're all in the last quadrant of their life now. And they all started out with the same sort of optimism. My friend was telling me how very sad it is, because all of them, except for her, they're just disappointed now. Which is how you really often see older people, and they're not, what makes them old is that sense of disappointment, that it just didn't come out right. They either didn't get what they wanted because it turned out to be a lot harder than they thought it was to get it, or they got some of it and then it was disappointed. You know, parents, children die before their parents, and you know, you're widowed or you're deserted or whatever might happen. Or you got everything that you wanted, but you still don't find Satchitananda because you never thought about your inner consciousness. You just thought about your home and your car and your furniture and your garden. And now you have it all and you're just sitting there. So what happens is, after we do that enough times, and this is the principle of Sanatana Dharma, the next time we're born, we remember. And instead of just turning our back on the wall and wildly, you know, going out one more time to fill our bag with stuff, we're just a little suspicious of this whole proposition. That's essentially how I was born. I mean, I know that I've been on this path for many incarnations. I wouldn't have been so able to embrace it so completely if I hadn't already been through a lot of experiences. But I was so puzzled. I was puzzled by everybody else's attitudes. They were just so determined that I should just turn my back on, I didn't know the wall was there, but that I should just get a big sack and start filling it. And I kept, I mean, I didn't know how to ask the question, but the question I kept wanting to ask was, how will that make me happy? Because I knew that being happy was what I was seeking. And they essentially just said, oh, don't ask that question, just fill the bag. But I kept thinking, I know, no matter how full this bag gets, that it's not necessarily going to make me happy. So why would I spend all this time just filling the bag? And the way I thought of it was, I could see the end of all these roads. I'll become a professor, I'll become a doctor, you know, I'll become an attorney, I'll become anything. But the end of all those roads, it's not what I'm gonna find looking for. So I sort of describe it like I just kind of stood there. I participated, I was perfectly well adjusted, seemingly. But I always felt like I was leaning against the wall, just trying to figure out what the heck is going on here. And then when I was 18, somebody gave me a book about Sanatana Dharma. And as soon as I read it, I thought, there it is. Somebody's actually talking to me about what I really want to know. And 4 years later, I met Swami Kriyananda. And then I thought, oh, now here's somebody who actually knows what you're supposed to be doing in life. I had discovered someone who was tunneling through the wall, who would talk to me about the wall and talk to me how to get through it. And I turned in that direction and never looked back. 50 years ago is when that started. But it's because I had been through other lives. When I said to Swami Kriyananda at one point, I said, Swami, I was so intent on becoming happy, being happy in this life. I said, it was just an obsession with me. I said, but I was never unhappy. I never suffered. I was born into a very pleasant family. I have a buoyant temperament by nature. I'm not depressive. You know, everything just went fine. It was all going fine. And I wasn't even unhappy. It wasn't like I was depressed and anguished. Everything was fine, except nothing was fine. And his answer to me was so obvious, but for some reason I needed him to say it. He said, past lives. You know, you've had those, you've had experiences in the past that have woken you up. So the whole reason for our existence is that we gradually need, a way to put it is very simple, we have lessons to learn. We're here because we have lessons. And those lessons are what will bring me closer to Satchidananda and what will take me away from it. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't put things in your bag. It just depends on what you're actually doing while you put those things in your bag inwardly and what you're actually experiencing. So the lessons are, what do we believe is real in this world? What do we think is the purpose of life? How do we define happiness? And how do we think we're going to accomplish, attain that happiness? And we make every decision that anybody on the planet makes is made based on two criteria. They think it will decrease their suffering or increase their happiness. And no matter how complicated your thinking, if you pull all the way back, you will realize that you're just motivated by two things. Pardon me?
Wow.
Yeah, wow. It's exactly true. You know, like, yeah, very simple. I'm feeling lonely. I think I'll call a friend. I'm feeling like deprived. I think I'll eat some ice cream. You know, I'm feeling restless. I think I'll go buy a new dress. And just in some way, we think that it's going to make us happy, and we're either motivated, as I say, by one or the other. So the lesson is, what actually does decrease suffering? And what actually does bring us happiness? And when you start getting into this, this is where you end up with, you know, sadhus living alone in caves, existing on nettles, you know, just because they have really figured out that it's all about their inner consciousness, and they gradually absolutely need nothing. And in fact, they find the more stuff they have in their life, the more they're distracted from their inner consciousness. So someone who's really busy filling their bag thinks that these people are really deprived. But the people who are really in Satchidananda realize, why would I distract myself? There's a famous story, I believe it's an autobiography of a yogi, of Alexander the Great, who invaded India, or came close to invading India. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he invaded only close to India. But there was a... apparently Alexander was very interested in yoga, in Sanat and Dharma. He was interested in the power that he saw here. He was... This is a true story. He was, you know, the most powerful man in the world at that point. He commanded armies and was just marching across the planet, conquering. And he heard about this yogi, and so he sent one of his men to say, you know, Alexander summons you to come before him, and if you refuse, you know, I'm authorized to cut off your head. And he said, and the sadhu, just leaning against a tree, said, if Alexander wants to see me, he can come and see me. And if he wants my head, he can have it. Because even his physical body would not have affected his state of consciousness. And so Alexander was intrigued by that, and he came and talked to this man. And he said, you know, come with me and I'll give you riches and I'll make you powerful. And he said, what would I do with any of that? The sadhu said, how would that help me? You know, because he just learned it all. How will that help me? As long as I have my inner consciousness, which I have completely right now, take my body and what do I need? And as the story supposedly goes, Alexander said, well, is there anything I can do for you? He said, yes, where you're standing is blocking the sunlight, if you would move over a little. Now, examples like that, this is where India has always been the guru of the planet, because this is always where this has always existed. You know, it's outside of ritual, outside of religion, outside of anything, just these individuals who have tuned in to the fact that the only thing that matters is my inner consciousness. And when you have finally understood that, none of this really seems like a problem. You just go through it. But now all of us are somewhere in the middle. So what we don't know about what actually contributes to Satchitananda, what we don't know about where our suffering comes from and where our happiness really comes from, those are our unlearned lessons. And another word for that is very simple. That's what the word karma is. People talk about, well, this is my karma, that's my karma, it's a karmic lesson. Everything is karma. Because what happens to you is what you need to have happen to you to teach you a lesson that you don't already know. But the lesson actually is very directional. And that is to understand where happiness comes from and what causes suffering. And this gets us back to my inner consciousness versus my circumstances. And sometimes what happens to us is that our circumstances are completely shredded, exploded, cataclysmically destroyed, so that we're thrown back on the only thing we ever had anyway, which is our inner consciousness. I read a little excerpt from a rabbi talking about the years in Germany, when the Jews were tested so severely. And this rabbi asserted that those years, as he put it, were the shining hour of the Jewish people, because our fundamental religion has always been that, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Judaism is a true religion. That's pure Sanatana Dharma. There is only one reality, and that reality is divine. So he said, when everything else was taken from us, we had the opportunity to really live our religion and stand up for what we really believed. What difference does it make? Now, he was a very enlightened rabbi, and almost no one listened to him, because everybody else was busy rightly pointing out that, you know, the people who perpetrated that did not get very good karma for what they did. They have some super big lessons that they're going to have to learn. But everybody's having the opportunity to work this out. And a planet like this one is just a place where a lot of individual souls come to work it out. And the world itself, externally, this is another system that has to be described, but this planet is a school. And it's for the benefit of the students, which is all of us who are incarnated here. There's no making the school perfect. The school doesn't even exist except as a place for us to learn lessons. And so the school, this planet, is set up to have just the right balance of light and darkness, so that those of us who've chosen to incarnate here, and there's lots of planets we can go to, will have the opportunity to work out our karma, which is to learn the lessons about suffering and happiness. Okay, does that all make sense? Okay, I spend a long time on this because if you can really grasp this, actually everything in your life becomes really quite simple. It doesn't necessarily become easy, but it becomes quite simple. Because anything that happens that disturbs your inner consciousness, you ask yourself, why am I letting this disturb me? What do I not understand? What karma, what karmic lesson is being offered to me by this, that I just got fired from my job and I'm about to get evicted from my apartment? And now I'll talk about how karma works, reincarnation and the chakras and so on. So, any questions or comments before we go on with it?
It's interesting because about two decades ago, in psychology, there really was a new idea of positive psychology, which incorporates many of the things
very
that
good.
You're talking about.
That's the thing about Sanatana Dharma, is that it's like picking everything up from the right string. And you can just trace that string, you know, way down into things that appear to be quite distant from it, but are still, nonetheless, they're pulling a thread of true perception. What causes happiness? What causes suffering? And somebody's gotten a glimpse of it. From Sanatana Dharma, you're at the top of the mountain and you can look all the way down. You can be, you know, just a tiny bit up the hill, but you can still be on the same thread. It's just, but you'll only know where you are and what's behind you. You won't be able to know all the way to the top. Paulina?
A question. There is a way through hypnosis to see in your incarnations.
Right.
Do you believe in that?
I believe it's possible to do that.
Okay.
And I believe that a lot of people who do that are touching into real things, and I think it's also possible to be, to fantasize.
Okay.
So it... My feeling about anything, whether it's psychic or hypnosis or anything, it's all in there. And this is when I get to the chakras. It's all there, so it's perfectly discoverable. You have been the same through all your incarnations, and you have experienced the you. I have to define what that you is. But there's I'll use the word here. The word is jiva, and there's no English equivalent. Sometimes people use the word soul, but soul is a little bit confusing. Jiva is your unique spark of individuality. That you, this is your bubble of the great sea. And you are always, the jiva is always there. You are always the same jiva. Very much like if you put on a complete costume with a mask and a wig and shoulder pads and elevator shoes and everything, you could make yourself look so different that no one would recognize you. But inside, you would still be yourself, wouldn't you? And everybody in the world would relate to you differently, yes?
And the purpose of jiva jiva is pure and noble, and it's like God inside
us? It's, if you think of the great ocean, and the ocean is made up of a whole series of drops, and each one of those drops being an individual jiva, no one drop is the whole ocean, but the whole ocean is composed of all its little drops. So yes, it's your pure dot of infinity, your pure dot of spirit, your pure essence of God, and it's why we're never content to be unhappy. Because we know ourselves to be a drop in the great ocean of Satchidananda. No matter what costume we're wearing, we always, some part of us, that's where we begin. And we're just trying to get that little drop of ocean back to the sea. Like water coming up from the earth just flows toward the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Another question is about karma. Always I thought karma is like your punishment.
No.
If you behave bad, this is your
punishment. No, if you behave...
It's a very bad connotation about it.
I think let's hold that question because I'll explain that next, and I'll explain it completely. Okay? So, because the individual jiva was always there through all those experiences, somewhere deeply buried within you is the active memory of all those experiences. And it can be brought forward, and it sometimes is brought forward for any number of reasons. Just I've had one dream in my life that was, it was just, I dreamt another lifetime, I know for certain. And I've had a lot of intuitions that explain the circumstances I'm in. I know why this is happening. And so I believe it's possible. And psychic, people who are psychic or who hypnotize you, it can be true. Whether every single detail is true or not, I don't know. My response is it helpful? Is it helpful for you to understand this? Does it really fit? You have to apply your common sense. Merely because it's far out doesn't mean it's true. So you have to, I often say, do you know the word apocryphal? Apocryphal means it may not be exactly true, but it could be true. And so sometimes I have the idea that maybe I didn't actually, you know, die. Maybe you didn't actually murder me. But if I think of you as my murderer, it certainly explains why I feel the way I do about you now. So it's apocryphal, and it's helpful for me to realize that this is where my fear is coming from. The past, it's not really in the present. You're no longer that person. You've learned your lessons. It's not my karma to be murdered by you. But somehow part of me thinks that I could be. And so a reincarnation in past lives helps straighten that out a little bit. That's why I'm so afraid of you. That's why I dislike you. Whatever it might be. Okay? And, yes, Linda?
Kind of continuing along those lines, what do you think about what are the lessons in the karma for those people that inflict pain on us, like, you know, the shooting and the terrorists and
right.
You know, those extreme cases?
Well, I'll give you a simple example. That, okay, everything is directional. What that means is that we are all progressing, and what is appropriate for a little child is not appropriate for an adult. What was appropriate, the example that is always used is, let's use Mahatma Gandhi, who was an attorney, he was a lawyer, and he engaged in the liberation of India. If he had decided in the middle of that campaign, wow, I have a worldwide reputation now. If I opened a private law practice, I could get so rich. You would think this man has really gone backwards because he had the potential to change the destiny of a whole planet, and instead he went to make money. Now, if you have over here somebody who's just been doing nothing but has been drunk on the couch for 10 years, and he finally decides that he's going to use that law degree he earned and he's going to make a good practice and make money, he's going forward. Same action, but depending on where you're standing, one is forward and one is back. Now, what happens to us is that we actually, this is a scary point, but they say that we have to learn everything. If we're not inclined now to pick up an automatic weapon and go mow down innocent people, it's because we tried it and it didn't work. That's kind of a scary thought, but that's that whatever you absolutely know will not ease your suffering or bring you happiness, it's because you experimented with it.
It's because what?
You experimented with it. You tried it. Now, putting that aside for a moment, talking about directional. The directional thought of somebody who goes and murders, for example, is that my suffering will be less and my happiness will be greater if I can expunge, if I can eliminate that which I think is irritating me.
Yeah.
Okay, like people who commit abortions. Abortion is such a sin, this person feels, I'm going to kill the people who kill babies because killing babies upsets me so much. If I kill you, I'm going to feel better. I mean, this is his thinking. If I'm an ISIS terrorist, and I think that the Western culture is such an abomination that God himself hates it, and I'm frantically and always intensely upset about it, I'm going to eliminate all the people who are part of that culture, I'm going to feel better.
Well, what is the karma that they were working out? And when they're thrown over the
karma they're working out is, my happiness depends on what other people are doing. And if I intensely, and they don't think, okay, think about this. somebody who's really suffering thinks that it's because these women are dressed in scanty clothes and that's what's making me so miserable. They're not realizing that what's making them so miserable is the fact that they're so obsessed with somebody who has nothing to do with them. And that's the inner reality they're living in, is that other people's actions control my happiness. So if I can get rid of those people, then I'll feel happier because they're actually causing my unhappiness. I'm trying to make it a principle, because the principle is, if I can absolutely change the world around me, then I'll feel better inside.
And if they don't feel happier, which they probably won't, will they live another incarnation?
They get to keep trying. And they may murder for a lot of incarnations until it begins to cross their mind that this didn't really work the last time and it's not likely to work this time either. Now, but what I want you to hear, because this is the important part of it, how many times, and you probably haven't actually ever murdered anyone in this incarnation,
no.
But how many times have you deeply and sincerely wished someone out of your life? And just really,
how many times
have you deeply and sincerely wished that somebody would just disappear from your life? And had, in other words, had the same impulse. I'm going way back, but way back, and the same delusion in your mind that my unhappiness is because caused by your actions, and if I could just get rid of you. And we might not murder them, but we might tell them to be different. We might scream at them. We might even hit them. It's a deep feeling that my unhappiness is because of you, and I'm going to solve it by getting rid of you. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't kick the bum out of your house. It doesn't mean that you have to just sit there like a doormat, because it's not how you behave exactly, it's what you feel inside. So when someone actually picks up a gun and kills them, that's much farther back, you might say. But you can see it's the same wire. Yeah, I mean, you know, you jealous triangles where, you know, she goes off with another man and he goes and he shoots that man, thinking that somehow that's going to get the woman back. You know, in his mind, that's what he thinks. The problem is not me or her. The problem is the third person. I'll go shoot him. And when they're doing it, they think it's going to actually help. And how many times when people are caught in some betrayal, do they dream about shooting the person who's betrayed them?
So when you're thrown over the wall into a new body, mm-hmm. and you have these karmic seeds, are you starting with a blank?
No, that's where the chakras come in, and I haven't gotten to it yet. That's exactly right. The chakras are the mechanism by which experiences are carried from lifetime to lifetime. The chakras are the mechanism through which karma goes on. And I think I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll go right there. But all of this is necessary, because otherwise, the whole system, you can learn it, but what difference does it make? So now that we've gone this whole distance of being thrown over the wall, lessons that we're trying to learn and so on, now we'll come very specifically to what karma is and how the chakras play into it, and then, obviously, what we can do about it. Okay? So let's take about 10 minutes. So now we're really going to go into the karma chakra's real part of this, because once we have that picture. So we have the idea that the point of all our many lifetimes is that we have unlearned lessons that we're trying to learn. We, in the answer to Linda's question earlier, when I was talking about actions and understandings being directional, what would be backwards for Gandhi could be forward for your drunk uncle. You know, the same action, but it depends where you are on the spectrum, whether you're going forward or backward. So the chakras, which I'm just going to draw the simplest stick figure here, and I'm not really going to be dealing with them. This is the navel chakra, and then this is the heart. So there's a chakra. This is, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. This is the throat chakra, 5. And then this is the 6th chakra, which is the spiritual eye, and then the 7th chakra is the crown chakra. Okay? 6, 7. Yogananda also has, he also has the medulla, which is also, the medulla is this space right here. And this is actually also the 6th chakra, because these are the opposite poles of the same chakra. And I'll explain that.
6 and 6.
Yeah, 6 and 6. Opposite poles of the same chakra. That's something he added to it. And I'll explain that more clearly in a few minutes. Now, it's very important to understand that every chakra is positive in the sense that it's not like the lower chakras are evil and the upper chakras are good. It's they're all a certain vibration of energy. Let me think how to say this. This I want to say it. Every chakra has a positive expression. Positive means expanding you toward perfect happiness. And every chakra has a contractive expression, which is contracting you away from your perfect happiness. All right? Now each of these chakras has a particular quality that it relates to. Let me see if I can... Okay, the first chakra, and there's many different systems, and I'm just going to touch a little bit. You'll have to go to YouTube and watch the 4 classes. The first chakra represents security and the quality of loyalty. The second chakra is creativity. People tend to think of that as sexuality, but it's creativity is a better word. The third chakra is willpower. And the fourth chakra is, people call it love. Well, love is good enough, but love is not quite the right word. It's, I'll just call it love. But that means that you expand your self-definition to include others. Okay? And then the 5th chakra, it can be talked about as communication. These are good words for the way we're focusing it today insofar as we're doing that, which is relationships. And the 6th chakra is the spiritual part of it is attunement with a greater reality. And this is when you are free, freedom, complete Satchitananda. And the medulla is attunement with a lesser reality instead of with a greater reality. Now, to express the positive and negative each side of this, Paulina, do you have a question?
No.
Okay, this is only one tiny little way to talk about each chakra, but this is the way if we're thinking of relationships, which, as I say, we vaguely are. Okay? But what I want to show you is the positive and negative potential. The first chakra represents security, loyalty, groundedness. It's absolutely essential, because all of these chakras are required to be in balance and to be functioning together as a harmonious whole for us to avoid suffering and to find happiness. And so the quality of security, creativity, willpower, expanding your self-definition, communication, self-expression, all of those qualities are absolutely necessary for us to move well in this world. So you can't just cut some of them out. The positive expression is when we take that quality and we direct it in such a way that it moves us toward freedom. It moves us toward Satchitananda. The negative quality is when it moves us away from it. So let's talk about security. Where does our security come from? Does it come from having the people around us who are going to take care of us and protect us? Does it come from knowing that our children, that they're going to live close to us and I'm never going to be alone? Does it come from my keeping my physical body healthy? Or does my security come directed upward towards Satchitananda with the knowledge that God is in charge of my life and everything that happens is going to happen exactly as it is meant to? Now, if our security comes from our relationship to Satchitananda and our knowing that everything that's coming to me is a good thing because it's what I need and it's going to take me ultimately where I go. Now, that's real security, isn't it? But insofar as our security depends on the outward circumstances of our lives, we are always vulnerable. To a greater or lesser extent, depending on how the rest of the chakras work. For example, if you have a lot of willpower, even if you are, your security comes from the world around you, if you have a lot of willpower, you can affect that world around you. If you have a lot of creativity, you can affect that world around you a lot more than if you don't. So everything sort of works together. But the extent to which we're dependent on the world around us is the trouble we're going to have. I have a friend, she was from Nicaragua. This was now 30-some years ago, so I don't know the history of that region really well, but when whoever the dictators or the people who came in and took that country, they took her family home as their, as the presidential palace. I mean, that's where she was in that society. But it was all taken away from them. Her father moved, I think, from Nicaragua to Mexico. He built up a whole nother fortune. And then there was, it was, I don't think it was political this time. I think it was cataclysmic from nature. It was either fire or flood. Completely lost his fortune. The second time he built three fortunes and lost three of them. Because he had so much willpower and creativity that he could do it every single time. Nonetheless, you know, I mean, he was doing it for other reasons. I mean, he was also a very interesting man. And also the same loyalty. You know, we can be loyal, and it's very important to be loyal. In fact, Yogananda says loyalty is the first law of God. But if we're loyal to the wrong things, if we're loyal to some alcoholic bum whom we're constantly enabling to live his dissolute life, that quality of loyalty, which should be to the truth, to that which is right and righteous, instead that loyalty is given where it doesn't belong. So that's the negative expression. If loyalty is to truth, and what you're asking of me is not honorable, and out of loyalty to truth, I'm not going to do it. That's the right expression of loyalty. Creativity, in its positive form, is the ability to always see a new solution, no matter what's going on. I don't just mean making pictures and music, but creativity is just looking at a situation and finding a solution. That's the ideal expression of creativity because that's divine. And understanding that God will always inspire me and give me an answer. If there's a problem, there's going to be an answer. The negative side of the second chakra is that we're always restless and we're always trying to make something else happen. And so we're fickle. And so we're just always moving around and finding something new to do. Positive creativity is always finding a solution that moves us upward. Willpower is either used to discipline yourself to high ideals, or it's used to impose your will on the world, whether the world wants it or not. You can use willpower to create, but if you use it in harmony with higher values, that's different than just using it to get your way. Love, expanding your self-definition, which is to really take on other people's other realities as your own, your children, your friends. But also, the negative expression of this is once you begin to love them, you think you own them. And you begin to think that they own you. I mean, or they owe you, is what I actually was going to say. And then, if it's wrongly offered, then when they leave, you feel that you have been destroyed. But if you're loving all as an expression of the divine, and you're loving, the word is impersonally, because God has given you these people to take care of, then you're always loving on a more transcendent level, and what you really want is the welfare of the people around you. And of course, the welfare you want for them is not just right now that my little baby never has to face any obstacles. It's rather that you want that people you love to be free just as you want to be free. And if they have karma to face, they have karma to face. I read recently that helicopter parenting, which you may have all heard that phrase, where you're always hovering, has advanced to what they now call lawnmower parenting, And lawnmower parenting is when you go out ahead of your child and plow down every obstacle.
Yeah.
So that the
no-plow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But what that means is, who are you loving?
Yeah.
I mean, what are you really helping your child to become who he or she is meant to be if you're constantly trying to live their life according to your idea of what would be good? That's where your self-definition has become contractive instead of expansive. Communication, self-expression, is the negative. The negative it is that you speak untruth. And the positive is that if you speak at all, sometimes silence is more true than any speech. But that you whatever you say is inspired from a higher level and not just in service to your contractive ideas. Now, if we're going to talk about relationships, you can see how all of these are involved, but I'm not going to go there yet. And then the medulla and the spiritual eye, in a very real sense, is like this is where the jiva resides. I mean, of course, the jiva resides in all of it.
Number six?
Pardon me?
The number six?
Yeah. In this sense, it's like this is our individuality. The sixth chakra is our individuality. The spiritual eye is understanding that my individuality is a spark of divinity. And the medulla is when the jiva has become identified with, the individual is defined as my body, my needs, my individual separate temporary reality. At the medulla, we're identified with the temporary. At the spiritual eye, we're identified with the eternal. Now, bear in mind, we have to run the system. You know, here we are, even if we are a bubble in the ocean of Satchitananda, we've been given responsibility for this experience. So it's not like, well, I love the acting, the idea of acting on a stage. If you have a part in a play, you have to play it, you have to do it right. You can't do it badly because it's not really me. You have to really do it. So we have a part in the play. And the part in the play is Linda and Asha and Jan, and we have to play the part, we have to play it well. But from the spiritual eye, we know it's, as Swami used to say about himself, he said, I never identify with Swami Kriyananda. I consider Swami Kriyananda to be an event for which I am responsible. Mm-hmm. And he was very responsible carrying out the Kriyananda event. But he never allowed himself to be identified with the medulla, which is the Kriyananda is who I am. He always was identified with the spiritual eye, knowing that he was a spark of the infinite who had to play out the Kriyananda part. And he did it, you know, with great enthusiasm and with total commitment. But when he died, it was just like he just closed that little window and went back. There was no big necessity to, you know, give up and let go and or cling or not. Just gone. The party's over. It was a great party. You know, and it was a great party. It was a fantastic party. Okay? Now, from complete identification with the spiritual eye, and the seventh chakra opens when everything is in harmony at the sixth. So when I talk about them, I don't usually talk about the seventh, because the way Master said is you bring all of these, you bring the ego to the spiritual eye, the spiritual eye then harmonizes all the other chakras, this opens automatically. Other people will teach you differently, but that's how Yogananda taught it. Now, the other way that we think of these chakras, another way to think about them, this is earth, this is water, this is fire, this is air, this is what Yogananda called ether, which is more subtle than air, and this he just made up the word and he called it super ether, which really doesn't have a meaning, but we just make it up. Okay? So, thinking of earth, and I'm just going to go from super ether to earth here. Characteristic of earth is to be completely defined and committed by material things. And if you think of it in terms of my individuality, it's that who I am as a separate individual is who I am. This is all about self-definition. You know, on the material plane, this is an eraser, this is a pen, and they just won't go together. You know, things are separate on the material plane. if we could actually see these, even science tells us, these are just vibrations of energy. They're vibrating at different rates, which is why they don't go together, and they appear separate to us because we're looking, we see things in a material way. But you can take psychedelic drugs, and you'll sort of break that temporarily, and I don't really know what you're doing when you're doing that, but it does look different. Or you can advance spiritually, and you can begin to realize that all these separate forms are just vibrations of energy. And you can read the formulas in physics. A person could, I can't. But you could read the math formulas, you could read the physics formulas. It's going to tell you that these appear to be separate, but they're not. They're just vibrations of energy. But when we're identified, you know, when we're identified deeply with the earth element, then we are committed to that. And everything that happens to me is separate from what happens to you. So you ask the question, Linda, how can people do these really brutal things? Well, you're completely separate from me. I can do anything I want to you. It has nothing to do with me. There was a very touching story I read in Reader's Digest about a woman whose daughter was murdered, and the murderer was apprehended and sent to prison. But she found herself absolutely consumed with hatred. And she finally figured out that, you know, not only had her daughter been murdered, but the murder of her daughter was also murdering her. And she realized she didn't want to go there. So she had this idea that she would go to the prison and meet the man, talk to the man who killed her, his daughter, her daughter, thinking somehow that would help. It was a divine impulse, as it turned out. So she goes and gets acquainted with this man who grew up in very tough circumstances. And what gradually comes out is he never cognized that this person that he killed even existed. Like, he didn't think about her life being snuffed out. He didn't think about her mother's pain. He needed her purse. And she, you know, so he killed her so he could have it. It just, he was so identified that because he was the eraser, the pen just didn't exist. Pfft, who cares? But by meeting the mother and so on, and it became a very touching story of his awakening and her forgiveness, because she saw it from his point of view all of a sudden. That was a very basic lesson that he had to learn, is that other people are out there and they suffer just as I suffer. And when you begin to know that, you begin to behave differently, don't you? Now, at the spiritual eye, we have an actual experience, not just a philosophical idea, that everything in creation is just the same. That not merely do I have compassion for you or love you or admire you, but we're the same reality. There's just no difference between us. Now, And we make all kinds of decisions based on whether there is any difference between us and how much. I had a very interesting experience just the last few days. I was given this bicycle last summer with an electric motor on it, and I just love it. And I have been systematically collecting enough warm clothes so that I can wear it even when it's cold. And so gloves were a big issue, and I researched the internet, and Jan gave me some ski gloves, but they were too bulky. I didn't feel like I could. So I researched, and then I found a pair of gloves. They were about $35, which is not cheap, but and I read all the reviews. I got just the right glasses. They're gloves that you use for horseback riding, and they're really warm and they're terrific, and I was just loving them. And then on Thanksgiving Day, I had a bunch of stuff in the basket in the back, and it tipped over, and I ended up with only one glove. And I realized it, and I drove all the way back to the church and all the way back looking for the glove, finally realized that it had been right behind me from when I started looking. And so when I finally got back to the starting point, there it was, just sitting on the ground. So I picked it up and put it in the basket. 2 days later, I'm riding again, and once again, it had never happened before. My bag falls out of my basket, and when I get home, I have only... No, before that, when I got to the church, I have only one glove. So I redo the whole route again, but this time I don't find the glove, and I never did find it. So my beautiful gloves are lost, but here's the rest of the story. Now, why am I telling this now? what on earth, why on earth am I telling this now? Anyway, 30 years ago, I was in San Francisco. I was with Swami, actually, in San Francisco. And on the sidewalk, there was a pair of very nice black leather fur-lined gloves on a very, very busy sidewalk. And, you know, I picked them up. You know, I kind of tried to see if they belonged to him. And they were just my size. They were very nice gloves. I thought, and I took them home. And I've had them all this time, but I have never forgotten that I picked them up off the sidewalk. They weren't mine. But I took them. I mean, somebody else might have taken them, but I didn't have to take them. And I've never felt comfortable with those gloves. And when my one glove got lost and my you know, my precious gloves were taken from me, I thought, well, finally, the karma's even. And it really is. It really is. And I've never given those gloves away, but now I will, the ones I picked off the sidewalk. But now, it had to do, yes, this is what I was going to say. Here's the point. Every time we make a decision, we're making a decision as to whether or not I am one with the infinite and the same as everyone, or whether I am separate and I can just take from myself and it really doesn't affect anybody if it works for me. Right? And if you think again about every single decision you make, it falls somewhere on that spectrum. This murderer wanted the woman's purse. She was in his way. He eliminated her. No problem. He ended up having to go to prison, but that was something else. In the actual action of killing her, he never thought about it. Whereas, you know, Swami Kriyananda, even though he was deeply appalled by the Nazis and that whole that was happening in Europe, he grew up in Europe, he absolutely knew he could never pick up a gun and shoot anybody. Period. He just simply could not do it, regardless, because he was too deeply identified with a greater reality. But for some people, their loyalty to their country, their willpower, their expanding your self-definition to be my country could be a forward action. And now becoming a soldier so you get to murder could be a low action. But somewhere on the spectrum, every decision that you make reflects what you think is real and what your state of consciousness is. Right? And so now here we go. Now we're really getting finally into the chakras. The chakras are not a fixed thing. They are a vibration of energy. It's called a vritti, and vritti means whirlpool. And at the center point of it is, I picked up these gloves, which were not mine, and I took them. So at the center point was the fact that I stole something. Yes, it was sitting on the sidewalk, but still I took it. It wasn't mine. And so all this time there's been this vritti of energy floating around the fact that I took something that wasn't mine. And finally, it took two tries, but finally that vritti caused my glove to be taken away from me. And I mean, you might think I'm just being superstitious, but I'm not. It's a direct relationship. And it amuses me that I managed to thwart my karma once, but the second time, wherever the darn thing went, same road, same route, wherever the darn thing went, it's gone. Maybe somebody else picked it up this time because it's a darn good glove, but it's only one. Maybe I should go throw the other one out on the street at the same place.
What does it mean of vritti?
Vritti means whirlpool. Okay. And we speak, you'll hear us speak here of vrittis of karma. Because this is a vritti of karma. My taking those gloves created a vritti of karma. And each of these, the chakra, the word chakra itself means wheel. Because it's a spinning wheel of energy. It's not a thing, it's a spinning wheel of energy. And every vritti has a center point, and that center point somehow relates to your consciousness from absolute separateness to absolute unity. And so everything you do gets stored in whichever chakra vibrates with that action. And then gradually over the course of an incarnation, your chakras develop a very strong pattern. And the pattern that they develop, it has nothing to do with what you think you're doing. It has to do with what you're actually doing, which means if you can be as pious as you like and say all the right things, but if you really are deeply identified with the material world, your energy is going to go into that chakra. This is metaphysics. It's a mathematical, objective relationship. Has nothing to do with what you call yourself, what religion you think you are, what prayers you say in the morning, what rituals you do. It's actually how you vibrate. And so when somebody says something unkind, or you're walking down the street and you think, my, that's an ugly woman, and you just project a thought that just says, my, that's, she's ugly. Now, you know, to project out the thought that someone is ugly, I mean, it's a very hurtful thought. So you must be identifying with yourself as separate from that person. Instead of from the compassionate center of everything, you would look at a person who, let's say, looks ugly, and what you would feel was great sympathy. I wonder what suffering has caused that person to develop such an ugly face. And you would pray for them. Yes?
But did you say it doesn't matter what you do?
No, what you think you're doing. It matters what your actual vibration of consciousness is. So you can call yourself an atheist, and you may actually be vibrating at a great sense of unity with the whole planet. You may call yourself a Christian, and you might actually be separate in your thinking that you're really vibrating. You're not really vibrating at a very high level. When I said what you think you're doing, I didn't mean that you're kind of stupid and you can't figure this out. It means more, it's not the facade that you put on. It's not the outfit you wear. It's who you actually are and what you're really doing.
So the spiritual practices help
you? Oh, absolutely help you.
Change the vibration.
Exactly.
If your vibration is
exactly awful. Exactly. You meditate, you experience this power, mm-hmm. you feel inside yourself the recognition, oh look, when I meditate, my inner vibration becomes very harmonious, and that really makes me happy. And then you pick up a pair of gloves that are not yours, and it disturbs that inner harmony. And so your spiritual practices have given you a point of reference that tells you, I mean, that's why all these 30 years having those gloves has disturbed me, because they aren't mine. And when I took them, somebody else lost them. And there's no somebody else to lose them. You see how simple that is? When you drive down the freeway and somebody behaves badly and you start cursing them because they're such a stupid driver, what are you doing? You're affirming your separateness. So every single action comes somewhere on this scale. And the reason I mentioned that about it not being a question of the facade you put on is that you can have absolute faith that this is a very fair system. Nobody's doing anything to you. You're just vibrating, and then you develop these vrittis. Now, bear in mind, this is not a physical system. This is the energy system, the astral body is what we call it. The physical body exists because the astral body is behind it. And this is the mechanism by which incarnations take place. When the physical body dies, if you actually are with someone who dies, you watch their energy, their life force withdraws from the edges. If you're with someone and you want to know how close they are to dying, you can often feel their feet, because their feet and their hands will start getting really cold. They may still be breathing, but the life force is coming in, and so they won't. And they themselves will begin to lose their feet and their hands. They won't know where they are because the life force is withdrawn. And you can literally watch the life force go up the chakra. And in the way they talk about it is the body becomes paralyzed from the bottom of the spine. But that's what it does. It goes into the chakras and then it goes up and out. And whether it goes out through the spiritual eye or the medulla depends on who you think you are. Yeah.
Awareness and higher consciousness
first
through
them. It is. Now the thing about the chakras, and this is what I always have to say, you can look at it from this angle, and then you have earth and you have spirit, and so the first chakra is a lower chakra, which is how people talk about it. You can look at it from this angle, and you can say the first chakra is about security and loyalty, and there's nothing low about that. Security and loyalty are very important qualities. So it just depends on which angle you're looking at.
Can you be very strong with the third one, but not with the first one?
Yes, absolutely. You could have a tremendous amount of willpower, but no loyalty. So today you're advocating this cause and you're all for it, and tomorrow you're advocating that cause and you're all for it, and today you're in love with this one and this is where it goes, and tomorrow you're in love with that one.
Yeah. And it's also something that you see, when you start this, I immediately understand that I'm like, oh, okay, I'm very strong in this.
Exactly.
I need to work in this.
That's exactly right. Especially the five, well, all of them. But see, that's why you say, oh, look, and this is where you can start really becoming useful in your life. I mean, it's where spiritual practice becomes very practical. It's like, look, I really need to develop a sense of loyalty here. I need to really develop my self-expression. I need to really expand my self-definition so all my relationships are not always about me. But you still, maybe you're very loyal, but it's all about you. You know, you're very creative, and you always have, you know, wonderful new ideas. Or this is also sexuality, of great sexuality, but you have no loyalty, and so you have to start working with that, or you never express yourself. You don't have any communication skills. So when you start looking at relationships or anything in your life, you have to develop all of these, so you can see I need more first chakra energy, and see this is why it's not necessarily bad. I have lots of air. I can just go and love everybody. But I don't have any groundedness. I'm completely ungrounded. So you don't need to work on the fourth chakra. You need to develop the power of the first chakra. And then earth is very positive for you. That's why I said it depends on which angle you're looking at it from. And in relationships, earth is extremely important, especially the right kind of security. It's not that I get my security from you. It's that I'm deeply secure inside myself. And therefore, I can easily expand to love you and express myself. I'm not afraid. Now, when I'm talking about karma, and I'm talking about from the earth chakra to the spiritual eye, I'm using that as a way of describing from separateness to unity. And so in that sense, it becomes the negative, as I said earlier, the negative expression of the chakra comes into play. I'm loyal to the wrong things. I'm loyal to my own self-interest at your expense. And I'm not conscious of love or of divinity. And then, as I was saying, you build a pattern. And people who are psychic and can read or feel the energy of the chakras, they can look at you and they can know all about you, even though they don't know anything about you, because they can either see or they can feel these emanations. They can tell how your energy is distributed. They can read the vrittis. I mean, that's if they are actually doing it. Many people say they're doing it. With all due respect, they're not, but they think they are. But in principle, it's possible. And so what I started to say is when your physical body dies, the chakras are the blueprint. Just like I have the blueprints to this building. We have all the blueprints to this building. It's a big box of technical drawings. And all those drawings were in place, and this building is a complete reflection of them. They're not the building, but they're the blueprint that created this building. So the chakras are the blueprint that will end up creating the body. It will cause Paulina to be born speaking Spanish, Gopal to be born in India, me to be born in El Paso, Texas, wherever you were born. It's a blueprint that says, for this incarnation, this is what you're going to need. And then you will make not only a body, you will make a life based on this blueprint. And what this blueprint is, and there's the word, your karma. Because this blueprint is what you don't already know. That what you're going to need to experience in order to bring every chakra into its highest dimension and have them all be harmonized from the spiritual eye. What you don't know about loyalty, creativity, willpower, love, the blueprint is going to guarantee that you get to learn it. And this being an energy universe, these little magnetic fields of energy, it took 30 years for me to balance the karma of picking up those gloves. But just in the last 3 days, it came due. Mm-hmm. Why did it come due? I don't know, but it did. Maybe I'd actually, because I never had another pair of gloves.
Do you want to teach us how to work in the chakras, or that will be for another
work? I'm going to probably just send you to other workshops because I can't do everything in this. Yeah, but exactly, go to the internet or take another class here on the chakras because other people teach it differently. But yes, there are affirmations that go with each one. There's rituals that you can do, colors. There's a whole bunch of stuff. But this is just such a huge system. Yeah, yes.
Does the amount of energy in the working change based upon whether you're going positive or negative?
Well, absolutely. This is nothing but energy. There is absolutely nothing fixed here. So the way energy, think about it as if you were looking at a running river. And there gets to be a log jam over here. And so there are some twigs and things, not big. So the river's running like this. The energy is all trying to get to the sea, but some of it has gotten stuck over here and is whirling around this pile of sticks and branches. But if you can actually lift up those sticks and branches, then all that energy is just going to get drawn back into the river and flow, make its happy way to the sea. Or if you throw a lot of sticks and branches in, then the water that's trying to happily get to the sea is going to get sucked over into this whirlpool. Yeah, it is. That's exactly how I feel. I love it. So if you keep adding sticks and branches, if I keep stealing other people's gloves, you know, I'm going to keep a big vritti going of taking stuff that's not mine, and I'm going to keep losing stuff that is mine until it crosses my mind that maybe I shouldn't do this. At which point I will remove from the center what's holding it together. I'll take the sticks and branches out, and the energy will just go up. It'll head toward the sea, just like in a river.
Do we all have a fixed amount of energy? I'm thinking about is, you know, according to physics, the amount of energy is fixed, it can't be created.
You mean in the universe?
In the universe.
I don't see why that would be true. Energy is infinite. I don't know physics at all, zero. So I really don't know what that, but it may be within this creation. But, I mean, Satchitananda, it's an infinite, we're connecting with something that's infinite. So no, I'm just at a loss. You'll have to ask somebody who has a better brain than I do for that. Okay? I know enough to stay out of trouble. No, the truth is, it's really, I've never been able to think that abstractly. I really just can't. My mind won't do it. But I have lots of friends who love it. They're so inspired by it. Me, I'm just a zero. So I really can't answer that. The way I think about it is we are drawing our energy from the infinite source, and so therefore... But I'm sure that the two reconcile because we're probably just talking about different things and I just don't know how to bring them together. So, sorry. Yeah. Okay, does that... Yes, go, Paul.
The Sanskrit word vasanas. My understanding is their behavioral tendency.
Yes, inclinations.
Are they the same as vrittis?
Yes, they would be... If you... Okay, think of it like this too. If you habitually behave in a certain way, the more you do it, the more it becomes your habit. Isn't that so? You know, if when people ask you, try to get too close to you, you always find a way to say something rude so that they won't keep trying to become close to you. At some point in your life, you think that's the way to create happiness and to avoid suffering. And so it makes them go away. And so, so you get in the habit whenever people start trying to get too close to you, you make them go away. And so you begin to even be instinctively responding that way. And a lot of times you'll see in human relationships, somebody will bring something to you and you have an instinctive response to it. And you don't even stop and think about it. It's just how you respond. Because that's what you've been building that blueprint over and over again. In my birth family, my brother is a very, we tend to be articulate people and we tend to relate with words. My brother is brilliant and he was into competitive debate. He was actually the state champion of Texas 2 years in a row. And in my family, we never conversed, we only debated. And it wasn't disharmonious, it was just the way we talked to each other. And the way we talked to each other was, you mustered up your very best arguments and you presented them with all the energy you had, and then you sat back and the other person took their turn. I was 50 years old before I found out that debate and conversation were two different things. But when people would bring things to me, I would muster my best arguments and give my full energy. I didn't understand that does not invite a response from most people. Most people feel attacked and defeated. I just didn't know it because my whole life, that's how we did it. And so I had this huge vritti that had worked, and I was born into that family, and that's how we did it, and I was inclined that way anyway. But it caused me a lot of suffering.
So what happened when you were 50?
50, it just, somehow one day,
okay.
It just occurred
to
me.
It wasn't like a big event.
No, it just occurred to me that this was annoying people. And I finally noticed that other people talked differently. They invited response. They held their point of view back. They didn't try so hard to convince. You know, some of my friends are just like me, and we just debate all the time, and we're perfectly happy. We understand it. Others of my friends were constantly being offended for reasons I couldn't quite figure out. So I had to pull back, because that was my inclination. Yes?
So breathing is something negative? No,
it's just something is. For example, you can have a vritti of deep compassion.
So it's not good.
It's just energy.
Oh,
it's just energy.
Okay.
It's just energy held at a certain vibration. So you have vrittis in the upper chakras, you know, the inclination to feel great compassion, and you see somebody who's having a difficulty and you immediately expand your self-definition to include them. Mm-hmm. And so you're helping people on the street and you're helping your neighbors and you're a lovely mother to your children and you're a wonderful wife to your husband because you have strong vrittis to expand your self-definition. It's not at all negative. It's completely neutral in the metaphysical sense.
Okay.
Neither is favored. Just whatever blueprint you write is who you get to be.
Uh-huh.
And if you have been, for example, very, very greedy and have taken everybody's money but got away with it in this lifetime, but you still have a vritti of picking up somebody else's gloves that were not your gloves,
mm-hmm.
and it's still sitting there, so what's going to happen to you in this lifetime? Wow. There's a young man in our community who's so adorable. He never really got in a lot of trouble, ever. But every tiny thing he did, he got caught. You know, he had a learner's permit. How did it work? Somehow he had some kind of a driver's thing one way or another. I can't remember what the exact deal was. He went out of he was on private property. He went out of the driveway and back into the onto the driveway, in and out of private property, and he got the ticket right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like right there. Just every tiny transgression he ever did, he always got, usually by the police. You know, he got trapped by the police. I mean, kids do bad things. This kid never, he was out after curfew in the park, you know, he gets caught. It's because I think he'd been a bad criminal. I saw him once when he was 5, and he was dressed in a sport shirt that was hanging out in a pair of men's slacks, and he had his hands in his pockets, and he was just standing, just a kid, and I thought, this man has run like very seedy nightclubs. He just really looked like a bit like a bandito. And then as he got to be a teenager, this started happening to him. He had a vritti. It was a blueprint, but it was a blueprint of wrong action. But it was in between, because what it was he couldn't get very far into wrong action before he got stopped every time. You know, so maybe he died with regret. But it's complicated because, you know, the consequences of your actions won't necessarily come immediately because you can have a lot of other energy going on. And it just takes time for the metaphysics of the thing to work itself out. And but it will eventually, and if not in this incarnation, in the next. And you work on this blueprint your whole incarnation by every single thing that you do, regardless of whether you're thinking about it or not. We are always affirming a certain reality, and we keep making a blueprint. But we can change it repeatedly. I mean, I still am inclined to debate, but now I identify more with other people, and I remember that they have a reality that is different than mine. Whoa, how about that? This is not me. The whole world is not me. So we begin to change. So I begin to pull back that vritti of indifference or unawareness of other people's feelings, and I begin to build a vritti of patience and consciousness that I need to relate to you and not just to myself. What a novel idea.
So when you talk about the river and the vritti, and you put branches and everything, I thought like this is a bad vritti, right?
But it could also be good. You could be, okay, now I hear what you're saying, right. Because ideally, and this is where we are going, I see what your point is. Ideally what you want is you want all the chakras to flow open and free. And you want the energy all to be guided from here. So that the whole river is directed from the spiritual eye rather than being compelled by any of these particulars. And so that the energy is just directed through these chakras but not forced by the vritti. But you can have... You have vrittis that pull you down, and you also develop vrittis that pull you up. But sooner or later, all vrittis are dissolved. In fact, the definition of yoga, a yoga meaning union, not physical yoga, but the word yoga means union, in Patanjali is yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is the neutralization of all the vrittis in the spine. And then there's no vrittis. They just... Everything is run from the spiritual eye and nothing interferes. And the medulla, the sense of self, is shifted from separate individuality to divine reality, and that's everything. But in the meantime, we develop good vrittis, because then at least the energy is going in the right direction. You get, in other words, you get good karma. Selfless service, generosity of heart, positive attitude, courage in the face of obstacles, self-restraint when your own interests are at stake, but still you trust in God. All of these things start creating positive inclinations and positive potential for you. And then you refine them even more. It's nice to be charitable, but it's better to be attuned to God. But then you will be charitable because God told you to be charitable, not merely because, as Yogananda put it, it's your habit to be charitable. So everything goes more and more and more refined. That's why, for example, in Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda tells a story of going, he was in a neighborhood and someone had died, and he went into the house and he actually brought that person back. He resurrected their body. He brought the soul back into the body. And then I think Swami asked him, you know, would you have... Why did you do that? He said, well, God told me to do it. Would you have done it if God had not told you to do it? Oh, no, of course I wouldn't have done it. He could have, but he wouldn't have because he was only directed from here. So that's why sometimes it's your habit to be compassionate, but you're always trying to help everybody when it becomes out of balance for you to do that, because being charitable is not the point. Being in harmony with divine will is the point. And sometimes you actually don't help people's karma because you're so compelled by your vritti that you're actually not serving their cause. You're a lawnmower mother, right? Because you're compelled by your vritti, even though you're behaving in what looks like a generous manner, but you're not really calmly attuned. You're actually being forced. So in what you're tuning into, Pauline, is true. All vrittis are bad. Some of them are just at a higher vibration than others, but in the end, they all have to go away. The river has to flow completely free. But in the meantime, you try to scoot them up. Yeah.
Is it possible to go in a negative direction? Mm-hmm.
My goodness, yes. Seemingly endlessly. Yes, you don't have to learn anything. You can just keep insisting on your point of view forever. Sooner or later, they say, in the great vast scheme of things, eventually your own suffering will drive you, Because this is Sanatana Dharma, this is not religion. This is the way we are made. That certain things cause us suffering and certain things cause us happiness. But we can be as stubborn as we want for as long as we want. Literally, just...
But if we're being stubborn, are we not just staying where we're at and not advancing?
Generally speaking, you go forward or backward. You can't stay still. Because this is dynamic. So you're constantly making decisions. And if you just keep making the same bad decisions, you're adding more and more and more. It's not...
Well, like it's the ego? Here.
Ego is a very good, very good, you have good questions, Pauline. Mm-hmm. Ego is the infinite self identified with a limited reality. Okay, so ego is identifying with a limited reality. And that's why we say the medulla is the source of the ego, because it is the infinite self, but it is identified with a limited reality. And it's so the ego is actually, it just is what it is. It's not like your ego is this big enemy. I don't think it serves people to talk about the ego as a big enemy, because it's you, and you don't want to be at war with yourself all the time. But it's just, you know, I identify with a limited reality, and then I make decisions that aren't as good as if I identify with an infinite reality. But, you know, we have to be realistic. We do have egos. We all have egos, and we do identify. So we just have to gradually refine it. You can't just throw it away all at once.
So if you do keep on going, let's say backwards and, you know, limited awareness, when you pass from this lifetime, you start at the same...
You start exactly... You have, at the end of this lifetime, when your physical body falls away, you know in the movies how they have it? Like the actor stays on the bed and then the actor gets up and he's just the same, except he can walk through the walls and all of that. But he has the same personality and the same feelings and so on. It's not entirely accurate, but it's pretty close. It's just go home and take off this particular outfit, and how have you changed? Swami Kriyananda just put it like this: nothing happens when you die. That's what he said. Nothing happens. You take off this body, but you are this pattern of energy. It's just you're not wearing a physical body anymore, you're just wearing an energy body. But it, they say, in the astral world, it looks very similar, and it vibes just the same, because it just is what it is. And then when you're ready, you hang out in the astral world, as long as it is beneficial to you to do so. Because you can also work out karma on the astral plane. Because it's the way they say it is, this world is a reflection of that world. This world is like a smaller version of that world, a more condensed version. That's really the source. So you can go there, and we all have our friends and our relations, just as all these experiences people are having and talking to us about.
But we're not in a physical body.
But we're in a body that we can see. But it's just a pattern of energy, just like in the movies. There it is. It looks very much the same. But it doesn't relate to the physical world in the same way, and it can move about much more freely. And for example, people who love beautiful music and beautiful art, and you really love it in the astral world, because you can make beauty so much more easily. Or if you do essentially what you do here, and you have relationships and you have lives, this is as I understand it, the astral world can see this world if you're highly advanced. If you're advanced enough, and so a lot of you're being helped. You feel your dead grandmother helping you. I feel my friends who have passed sometimes, I really know they're helping me. I have one particular friend, I mean, she passed 20 years ago, but she's still my friend. I can feel her at specific times, and if I talk to her, I can feel her response. I believe she's in the astral world and she's helping me. We're busy. We just, nothing happens. It's just a different world. Now, but we have vrittis, we have karma, vrittis, karma, unlearned lessons, they're sort of all the same, that require a physical body to experience properly. Maybe we have a strong desire to smoke cigarettes and we died with that desire, or to get inebriated on alcohol, or to eat apple pie, or to be pregnant and give birth. Or to, you know, visit the Swiss Alps, or to, you know, or to be the mother of little Harold or whoever it might be. I mean, just all these things that would require a body, a physical body. So as I understand it, what happens in the astral world is that everything's going along, and that at a certain point we become restless. And these, and it's just, it's time to go
over the wall.
Over the wall. And we have the opportunity when the sperm and the ovum come together, there's a flash of light in the astral world. And whoever is ready to incarnate, who is in tune with that light, and I'll quote Yogananda, rushes to try to get into the womb. And sometimes more than one gets in. But I don't exactly understand that, because that also says that you have lots of different places you can incarnate. See, what you're looking at is, you're looking for the planet. We don't always come back to this planet. There's lots of planets. For the planet and the circumstances that are sufficiently related to your blueprint that you will be able to act out your blueprint. But bear in mind, there are lots of things in your blueprint. So if somebody gets into that womb ahead of you, you have other lessons that you can learn. It's not like if you have to be very, very refined where there's only one possibility. But, for example, let's say Mexico is a little bit more relaxed in the way they approach life than Germany. Or America is more comfortable than Sudan. And so you're looking, and in some way, how this works, I don't know exactly. You're looking for the environment, starting from your parents all the way out, that will facilitate the working out of your karma. And sometimes it's a balancing. Like in my case, I had a lot to learn about using my willpower and my communication without taking my heart into account. So for a long time I wondered why I wasn't born somewhere that would have balanced those qualities in me. But I realized what actually happened and often happens is karma gets pushed even farther until you yourself realize, wait a minute, this is not working for me. So I was born into a family that pushed that particular karma because it was really something I have needed to learn. It pushed it very far until I got it. And then I was finally willing to put out real energy to change it. Simultaneously, you can see that I've made my whole life on that same characteristic. And so that family was also extremely beneficial to me, given the blueprint, the destiny that I needed.
So what, for instance, if I was born with my blueprint and karma, and then 30 years later, you know, I had my kids who are like so different, were they brought into my life also to help me work out my karma?
Well, in some sense, yes, but not everything is entirely about you. I hate to be the one to have to tell you this. I'll tell you a funny story. There's a man in our community, at the community at Ananda Village, and he was a wonderful, he had no children of his own, he was a wonderful uncle to several generations of Ananda kids, really just great. He is a wonderful man, he was a teacher, kids loved him. He did all kinds of fabulous things with the children. But he was not their parents. And of course, the children are all being raised on this philosophy, so it's a great thing for a parent to have in their little quiver when the kid says, you know, I hate you, I don't want to be your daughter anymore, you're a terrible mother. And you just say, not my fault, you chose me. So the kids, we go to him and say, I would never have chosen them, never in a million years, you know, just like adolescents are. So he went to Swami and said, what's the truth here? You know, did they really choose those parents? Is that what I really have to say back to them? Because he said, sometimes I wonder why they chose those parents too. So what Swami answered, and it was very interesting, he said, you don't actually choose every little tiny detail. It's a broad pattern. And you'll take some part of it, and then a lot of other stuff may come with it. You know, like, for example, you may be very connected to your older brother, but the parents are rather incidental. Or you may be very attached to your mother, and the siblings are very incidental. Even the father could be very incidental. But it's like, you know, you have, this is the circle that you're doing, and then this is the person that you're connecting with, and you all connect like that. But that person has this whole other circle that may not actually touch you, but nonetheless it affects you. Yes?
For example, it would be like I feel in myself like my dad and my brother, they're like my soulmates.
Uh-huh.
And, but as you say, which I really like, it's not all about me.
Yes.
So maybe my dad has something to do with the woman he
exactly
chose, and it's nothing related with me.
Right.
And that woman, which is my mom, I have to learn a lesson. Right?
Well, there's always the anything that upsets your equanimity, anything that takes away your happiness, you've got karma that you have to learn. In some way, but it doesn't, not all, in families, and as an example, not all of those relationships are in and of themselves that important. And that's where common sense comes in. You just realize, I have a very deep tie with my brother and my father, and the rest of them are just there. But the fact that they can still upset you, for example, tells you that, well, I have an opportunity to learn something here. Mm-hmm. But just because they're in your life, it doesn't mean that they're really that important in your life. They could be there only for what it brings out in you, mm-hmm. not really for themselves mm-hmm. or circumstances. Or my favorite karma story of just so weird, this man that I know who was a ballet dancer, became an artistic director, he may still be working in the Midwest somewhere, beautiful ballet dancer and wonderful choreographer and just all these different things. He was born in Texas, which is, you know, and he was born in a cattle raising, you know, cultural desert of Texas. I grew up there, so I know part of this. Just this god awful, god forsaken place. He was the 12th child, and all 11 of his siblings are still there raising cattle. And he is a ballet dancer. Now, like, what? How did that happen? So you never, sometimes very odd things happen. But none of those people had much to do with him. He just, for some reason, he just had to be there. But he has nothing with any of those people. They were just the people for some reason. Who knows? Maybe the exact physical characteristics that enabled him to be a dancer were completely available in that particular genetic structure. And that was his destiny, and so that was where he was going to take it. I mean, anything could be true.
That kind of relieves the pressure of feeling like, oh, I should be close to my
exactly
sister. I should, you know, whatever.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. You're just not.
Yeah.
It's just these people are just there. They have, I mean, families, physical families, are just so temporary. Mm-hmm. When you think how many incarnations we've had to actually, I mean, and some of them are people who are really important to you, but merely because they're your family doesn't mean they're at all important to you. And it just, it has to be said. I mean, I've gotten myself in a lot of trouble with that one. But sometimes, for some people, they're very helpful because they compel people to face karma that otherwise they wouldn't have wanted to face. So for some people, to deeply identify with family is a step up. You know, to get far, get enough out of yourself to actually identify with your family, mm-hmm. that could be like progress. But for others, where you're already much more expanded, to have to just go back and identify with these people with whom you have nothing in common, it's not a step forward. I mean, whether you treat them unkindly, that's something else, but you don't have to pretend to closeness if you don't feel it.
Because you're going from the helicopter parenting.
Yes, exactly.
You're not
exactly. And even for your own children. As the Swami put it, I love the way he put this. He said, the parents create the physical vehicle through which the soul can express its destiny. But the parents do not create either the destiny or the soul. And it just, you know, that being comes into you fully himself or herself, takes on the body that you help provide and that you have to wash and feed and comfort and take care of forever. But it's going to follow its own destiny. You're not creating any of that. And, you know, one who really identifies with that person actually tries to do it from their point of view. It's not all about me. Okay? Yeah, it's very, very helpful. I mean, I talk to parents. My God, they're... I mean, I understand. I've never been a parent, so I understand how it feels, but really think how many parents you've had. There's bazillions of them, and your destiny is so much bigger than just this one. It's no license for irresponsibility, but it's just like, who is this person and where are they trying to go? Somehow that cattle ranching family just looked at this last one and just, I mean, because he had the opportunities. He said they really didn't know what to do with him, but he knew what to do with himself. But they looked at him and they just thought, you know, this one is really different. He's just, we're not going to put him in a Stetson and on the back of a horse like we did all the other 11. He's just got to go somewhere else. And so you actually look and say, well, who are you? Not my son, my daughter, but who are you? I mean, one woman I know, poor woman, she had twins. One of them was a dear friend and one was an old enemy. So from the moment they were born, she had an affinity for one and an aversion for the other. Mm. Yeah. I mean, talk about a trial for a mother. It wasn't so easy on the one she had an aversion to either, which is the one I knew. But all of this really helped. Oh, okay. It was hard on her too, because she's supposed to love her children equally, and she didn't at all, because the karma was completely different.
And the lesson was love. Right?
And the lesson was love, and yeah, and she was getting her karma back. I mean, they were old enemies. Now she had to be at close quarters. Master even said, you know, hate is as powerful an attraction as love. And sometimes enemies are born into the same family so they can fight it out at close quarters. Mm-hmm. Meaning that, you know, this belief that you really caused me pain, you get to find out whether it's true or not and just be there every day. Mm-hmm. So this woman had to be there with her own baby every day and try to overcome. Well, she didn't really try that hard, but that would be the theory. And who knows what the twin to whom she had an aversion to had done to the other woman, the other soul, in another lifetime. You know, we all have lots of things behind us. I mean, that is, and I will say it, a very tough teaching. To be able to take the law of karma all the way to no matter what happens, it's appropriate. You have to have a lot of courage to go there. Because that just goes... Because you see, if it's true, it's always true. There can't. If in fact we are moving with this blueprint of our own chakras, and it's just our own karma, absolutely everything is as it has to be. Which means that the victim is not a victim, no matter how it may look. Now, I understand how difficult that is, and it's an easy abstraction. It's very tough in the specific. However, what happens to us in life doesn't matter. All that matters is what we become through it. So you can watch people either be broken or be liberated by tough circumstances. There was a man named Richard Wurmbrand. He was a Christian pastor, and he had the misfortune... See, he was a Jew who converted to Christianity, so when the Nazis invaded his country, he got imprisoned as a Jew. And then later, when the communists took over his country, which was Romania, he got imprisoned as a Christian. So he got to spend a lot of his life in very awful circumstances. But he was a great saint. And he came to speak, when I lived up in Nevada City, he came to speak at a local church, and Swami Kriyananda knew of him, and a whole crowd of us went to see him. And there was another man who'd had very similar experiences, and the other man had been absolutely broken by them. Same experiences, but the other man was shriveled and small and trying hard to hold on to his faith, but Richard Wurmbrand was expansive and huge and full of love. Same experiences. So, yeah, who did what to whom? Because you're driven all the way. That's where the rabbi said being sent to the concentration camps was a divine opportunity for the Jews to go entirely to Satchitananda and shed every other identification or attachment. Would I have the nerve? I really don't know, and I am not looking to be tested. You know, yeah. Right. I don't want to be tested, but I am afraid to be tested, and therefore fear is unlearned karma. So who knows?
When you see that you did something wrong, and so you're afraid of the karma, what you can do?
Well, I'm certainly one who believes in going back and making it right if you can. I mean, a basic, if there's a way to rectify it, I think one should rectify it. One should apologize. One should make restitution. One should admit, as long as it does, you don't do it in such a way that it just draws more attention to yourself. You know, as Swami said, if all you do is throw dust on your own head, your point of reference is your own head and dust, and it's not very wholesome. But if, in fact, you did something unkind and can make it better, if you took somebody's gloves that don't belong to you, you can return them. If you can make restitution, I would definitely do it. If you can't, you can trust that once your vibration changes, once you are truly penitent and really recognize your error, that's all that matters. It doesn't matter what happens to us, it's what we become through what happens to us. If through the pain of the realization of the error, you actually shift your consciousness, then you've learned the lesson, the karma is done. You don't have to work it out with, if there's another person, you don't have to work it out with them. They may have to work it out with somebody else, meaning a stand-in for what happened with you, but you're done. So you just constantly work on your inner self. And once you get chakras, karma, reincarnation, I mean, you are so careful. You're just so careful, because if you do the wrong thing, it's going to come back on you. If you have a bad thought, it's going to come back on you. If you do something selfish, it's going to come back on you. So why would you stab yourself in the hand over and over and over again? So you don't even have to discipline yourself. It's just, why would I do that? Why would I even think about doing that? But the vrittis keep sucking us. The river's trying to flow up, but the habit is there. And we react before we even know it. We're yelling at someone. We're pushing their buttons. We're, you know, pushing them away. We're saying something unkind before we even know it. So then as soon as we know it, you have to pull back. I can hear certain tones in my voice. And as soon as I hear that tone in my voice, it doesn't matter what I'm doing, period, I stop. Because it just doesn't matter. I'm off. I know I'm off. And that's how I began to get a grip on some of these vrittis that were just compelling me. Because at first I paid too much attention to the specifics. Well, I'm really right, and you really did this, and this is my point of view, and this. But as soon as I heard that, I realized, oh, I've been sucked into one of these holes again. So you just work on yourself. This is lifetimes of work. But once you're trying to get back through the wall, instead of trying to fill your bag over here, then you're moving in the right direction. And there's also, the wind is at your back now. It begins to help you. When you're going this way, you're pulling away. Well, if you want to think of it devotionally, you're pulling away from God. When you turn back this way, you're going toward. And so he starts helping you. Does that make sense?
Yeah. How about balance? Like, life is so attractive, so fun, so, I don't know. And always when I'm in this kind of teaching, I get like, boy, I don't want to do that.
No, that's a false teaching, and let's not go there. Okay, you are standing exactly where you're standing, and you need to have the experiences that your karma wants you to have. And what you want and what you enjoy is a fundamental part of your karma. And to just not do it because you think it's bad, not only will you not get over the desire for it, but now you have put a whole nother layer of guilt and fear and shame on top of it. Useless. Absolutely useless. Go out, be the most, you know, sensual, vibrant, put on your disco clothes and go dancing, if there are even discos, whatever people do. Just go out every night. You know, just do whatever you want to do. But do it in as uplifted a way as you can.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Because you have to be You can't follow someone else's karma. Mm-hmm. What you have to do is you have to have your own experiences and then just pay attention to them. Just pay honest attention to them. And at the point at which you no longer enjoy it, that's the point when you put it down. Gandhi, who was, of course, one of the most disciplined in the world, said, never give up a pleasure until you have replaced it with a higher pleasure. Mm-hmm. And that's the way, if I feel like doing it, I do it. I only give something up when I don't enjoy it anymore. Then why would I do it? And then sometimes there's a middle ground of battle. Mm-hmm. But if it's a middle ground of battle where you know what you're doing, you know, I know if I eat all that ice cream, I'm going to feel really terrible in the morning. I know that if I stay home and really do the work I'm supposed to do and make progress on my projects, I'm going to feel a lot better than if I just go out and play tonight. And so there's discipline involved and even a little bit of rats, you know, oh, rats, I have to do this. But still, you know what you're doing. It's not, oh, I feel so good, I really want to do that, but I shouldn't. Don't ever be at war with yourself. It will absolutely take you nowhere. But pay attention to what really works and don't become stubborn about insisting that this is really a good idea when it clearly isn't. I'm glad you asked. That's a very important question. Yeah. I feel it like not only do I have a desire to go out and do this thing which I know is really unhealthy for me, that's a problem. But if I feel really guilty about it, then I have a whole other problem. And this is a simple problem. I'm just going to keep doing it as long as I enjoy it, and one day I won't enjoy it anymore. But if I'm guilty about it, I tend to lose track completely of this, and all I've got is guilt, which is much more complicated than just a simple desire. Because desires either fulfill or they don't, and they teach you all by themselves. You don't need another layer. And then also having the simple courage to say, this is who I am. Someday I'll be better, but not yet. We used to have Halloween parties sometimes, and that we would have people, we had one where you came as you were. You got to dress in some past life incarnation. Something, and it was a lot of fun. And one man came all in black with his face smeared with black. And I said, well, who were you? He said, well, I used to be a lot darker than I am now. So he was a little bit of darkness from his own past. And that's just a simple way to think of it. Darker in the sense of, I used to do things that now I realize don't please me. I mean, think how many times you've transitioned already in your life. You know, the things that you used to think were great fun, that they just aren't fun anymore. Mm-hmm. You just don't like them anymore. You didn't have to feel guilty or ashamed. You just yourself gradually transitioned. But if you just deny yourself and still want it all the time without being really centered and saying, I know why I'm disciplining myself. I'm disciplining myself because I really know this is the right thing to do. It's authentic. Okay, I'm sort of at the end of my story. Are there any other questions or thoughts before we...
Yeah, where we can learn more about this? Or are you going to continue being in these workshops? Like, how to work in the chakras?
What I would do is I would go to the Ananda Palo Alto website. My own website is Asha... Asha Joy, that's my website. And you can click on the classes and everything there, and you'll go to a YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. If you go also to Ananda Palo Alto, you know, Ananda Palo Alto, from there, if you go to Asha's page, there's an alphabetical listing of classes. Mm-hmm. Plus, there are other people besides me who've given classes. There are courses. This is not really very well in any book. Although there is a book that Savitri has written called Chakras for Starters. I believe it's downstairs. To be honest with you, I've never looked at the book, but she's a very good teacher, so I suspect it's a very good book.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about people that work with chakras?
Some of them actually have insight and power, and some of them are just think they do. Mm-hmm. So just because someone thinks they do doesn't mean they do. It's a bit complicated. Mm-hmm.
So do you recommend something like this?
There's no... some people do good work. I just really don't know what to say. I'm just going to let it stand, and you'll have to use your own common sense with it. Just because somebody is telling you something doesn't mean they're telling you the truth. You have to use your common sense and not get sucked into it. However, many people have a lot of insight. So, but somebody who tells you they're going to clear your chakras, they're going to solve this problem, be a little suspicious. It's not that easy. But they can help you, because this is just energy, and somebody who has good energy, I mean powerful energy or positive energy, they can help you. Just like you go and talk to a friend when you're sad, and because that person loves you, you feel better. So somebody who doesn't know you but has good vibrations and has a little bit of an understanding of this, they can help you. But merely because they say they can help you doesn't mean they can. So you just have to use your own common sense. Yeah, common sense. Yeah. But I've had people help me. It's not, and I've been helped by people, but I don't seek it out as a rule, just because I don't. Hasn't served me to do so. But it's still very interesting.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's potentially true. What people are claiming could be true. It's not a dream. Just whether it is or not, you have to see. It's very trendy these days to.
Do you have an opinion about this bookstore East and West?
No. They're laughing, Paulina, because Ananda owns that store. We run that store.
We own that store.
Ananda owns and runs that store. And in fact, that's a very good place to go.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yeah, but I'm not going to vouch for everybody who gives treatments there.
What?
I'm not going to. Uh-huh. Endorse everybody that you'll meet there, but there's no charlatans there, and there's no bad people there.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's
okay.
Definitely the place to start. I was about to say that. Go to East West.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah. We keep it separate because it's universal and we're specific. You know, learn Master's teachings there, you can learn anybody's teachings. And so it's two different missions completely. There's a little overlap. You know, we feature Swami's books and Yogananda's books and so on, but we offer everything that we think is legitimate.
Yes.
You know, some people make claims that we wouldn't.
Yeah, different paths.
Different paths, right. Mm-hmm. So the people who are there have integrity. All the readers, everyone there has integrity. Okay. I won't swear that every one of them can do what they think they can do, but they all have integrity. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I won't swear that they won't. They can't either. It's just that I don't know them. The people at Ananda I know. The people at East West I don't know that well. But I respect them. And there's a lot of folks who've been there for a long time who are very good.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Certainly. Anything else? All right, great souls. That was interesting.